We're joined now by Todd Furman, our guy out in Vegas. Let's start with the Stanley Cup. It's going to shock you, Todd. But have you ever seen the Stanley Cup in Vegas? It seems like a place where it would have quite a lifestyle.
You know what? It's been in Vegas in the past. I've never actually seen it live here. It was on display for quite a bit of time last summer. I have seen it in the flesh when I was up at the Hockey Hall of Fame in Toronto. But the big question, Clay, is what's safer to be get close to? The Stanley Cup and some of the sordid stories we've heard about that, or these Vegas pool clubs that I know you're such a big fan of?
Yeah, the water's got to be pretty dirty. There's no telling about all the different things that are swimming around, the pathogens and everything else associated with that. I hope that there's a lot of chemicals to kill all of the danger there. The Stanley Cup obviously went to the first game with triple overtime, very good ratings, two big-time traditional six hockey markets. What kind of action is it getting in Vegas?
A series like this is actually going to create quite a bit of fanfare. Now, obviously, that's not comparable to the NBA Finals, the NFL, or anything along those lines. But when you have two marquee franchises with such prominent fan bases that send so many tourists out here throughout the summer months, I was told a lot of the sportsbooks had an electric atmosphere, and the books really needed to cater to the hockey clientele. You talk about the Blackhawks and the Bruins and that epic first game one that went to triple overtime. It'll be real interesting to see which team kind of can get the momentum and the Blackhawks maintain it, or the Bruins, if they can muscle it back. The series price, Clay, opened at the Blackhawks at $1.50 favorite. They're now out to about minus 240, a pretty customary move for a team that wins game one and holds serve, at least on their home ice.
All right, it's been wild in the NBA Finals. I mean, people enjoying it, but the games themselves haven't actually been that spectacular. We're tied at 2-2. It's now a three-game series. Take me through the evolution, if you could, of the betting market game to game, where every single game seems like its own unique, distinct narrative.
It's been a bit of a chore, but I will say one thing. The series price right now is the highest it's been in the favor of the Miami Heat. And while a lot of the media want to say that this series is going to be hotly contested the next three games, in the eyes of odds makers out here in Las Vegas, this series is over and done with. Miami will be anointed the next NBA champion, assuming that they take care of business. They've gone from about a plus 110 underdog, meaning if you put up a dollar to win a $1.10 before game four, now they're minus 260 favorites. So you'd have to come back and put up $2.60 to make back just a dollar on Miami. The interesting part of game four was actually the line move. The Spurs opened as a two-point favorite after their trouncing of Miami in game three. That number swung all the way to Miami as a one-point favorite. So to see a three-point move amid speculation with Parker's injury and everything else, still pretty pronounced, especially when Parker was upgraded probable and played. But the sharp money was on the right side, and Miami again entrenched as a 1.5-point favorite for game five. So it speaks volumes about the changing dynamic of this series.
Yeah, that is pretty wild. So that's amazing, isn't it? Can you even think of a parallel where a team has lost by 36 points, been on the road, and the money has all rolled in on them?
It's been pretty impressive. I mean, the trend has definitely been to back Miami after a loss. They've won and covered 12 straight in that particular stance. So some of that resonates with the betting public. But at the same time, the zigzag theory is a tried and true NBA handicapping method that people believe when you see teams that are this good and this talented, they're going to bounce back. And clearly regression hit hard for San Antonio, who lived and died beyond the arc. But it was more Miami's effort at the offensive end, getting the big three to step up, pouring in over 100 points. The Spurs just didn't seem to have an answer on that side of the court. And maybe Coach Spo, along with LeBron James and Dwayne Wade, have found something they think they can use to win back-to-back NBA titles.
What's wild about this is the Heat aren't just being able to win these games coming off of a loss. They are 12-0 since January 10th, I believe, is the date. Not just to win the next game. They haven't lost back-to-back games since then, but they've covered all 12. As a guy out in Vegas, I think if you kept started with $1,000, kept rolling that out, I did the math, you'd be over $4 million now. How unbelievable is that string?
You definitely have a nice payday, that's for sure. The one thing to keep in mind, though, is for folks that want to look at this and say these are all correlated events, the reality of it is each game is truly independent because Miami went extended stretches where they weren't favored. So to see them, it'd be much more unlikely for them to cover 12 straight games played in consecutive order than taken out of sequence, kind of looking for the motivational factor. But it's definitely unique, and books have seen that. But at the same time, it's really hard to adjust. You can't really inflate the price and change the market value for a particular team because you will create value on the other side. I will say, though, from speaking to some of the bookmakers offshore and here in town, Game 4 was probably the ugliest decision they've had both the professionals and the casual bettors were all on Miami. This game seems to be a little more split. By all indications right now, it's about a 60-40 ticket count in favor of Miami. A far cry, though, for games one and two, where it was predominantly Spurs money that came trickling in.
U.S. Open starts at noon on NBC. You can watch it there. Phil Mickelson, Billy Horschel at the top of the board. What do the odds look like? I know Tiger is always prohibitive favorite coming in. What has his number done? What are you seeing after the first 2 days of the U.S. Open?
Numbers have moved quite a bit, and I think right now when you look at the leaderboard, there are a couple of golfers, in my opinion, though, that don't offer a whole lot of value. Phil, clearly the favorite. He's the only golfer right now listed at less than 5-1. He's available at about 4.5-1 at this point. Then you're looking at the next tier of three golfers, Justin Rose, Tiger Woods, Luke Donald, all in that 7-1 range. Tiger actually went off right around 6-1, so his price hasn't changed all that much. But an interesting tidbit with him, when he hasn't been in the top five going into the weekend, he's never won a major, so something to keep in mind. Billy Horschel, the real X factor, 11-1. Be interesting to see if he can keep going the round he put together yesterday. He hit 18 of 18 greens in regulation. Have to imagine he'll struggle some as regression will hit there. Steve Stricker, though, I think he's the real interesting guy that sets up well on this course. He sits in that 10-1 range. And then when you look at some of the other guys, Charles Schwartzel and Rory McIlroy, the only other golfers out on the course, less than 20-1. But it's anyone's guess right now who will come through. Imagine NBC will be rooting for Rory McIlroy, Phil, and Tiger to be in the mix come Sunday after they play the 18 today.
There is no doubt at all about that. That's who NBC is rooting for, because that would give them unbelievable attention going into the weekend. Let's go with Game of Thrones. I know you're catching up. If you were setting odds, and we're not reading the book, but if you were setting odds on character survival rates, how difficult would that be at this point? Because there are so many people that get axed off in this. We don't necessarily want to give away the spoilers, so maybe we shouldn't do this. Spoiler alert, if you are watching Game of Thrones and you have not caught up, change the turn it down for the next 30, 45 seconds. All right, Todd, now you're looking at, you know, the narratives and everything else. You finished three games. We just had the Red Wedding. It was a complete and total disaster. What kind of odds do you give me on some of these major characters surviving?
Tricky part, and I'll tell a little anecdote real quick there, Clay. I tried to tweet out odds about characters dying, completely forgetting that the books chronicled the whole series.
Yeah. Oh, that's awesome. So how'd you do?
Everybody out there on Twitter drilled me for some of the odds and said they were the softest number set. That was a mistake I won't make again. but when you watch the show, it's real tough because every time you get attached to a character, they inevitably get killed off. Apparently, these Stark men go out of style as fast as just about anything else as far as the show's creator is concerned. The only character that I make a real long shot who I can't see dying anytime in the near future would have to be Khaleesi. I think she'd be about a 50-1 shot to be the next character killed. She seems to be the one they're building everything around, along with Arya Stark. Those would probably be the two biggest long shots on the board. Beyond that, I mean, I'll probably make Joffrey a short favorite to be one of the first to go when we see the start of Season 4.
I agree. I can't wait for it. It's rare to root for. There are only a few characters on good television shows that I've rooted for their death. You know, not in real time, obviously, character death. And Homeland, I'm obsessed with Homeland. I would actually raise money to have Dana from Homeland be a victim of a terrorist attack. I wish Abu Nazir would get her. There have been two seasons of Homeland. This is the daughter, Dana. I think she's the worst character. And then Joffrey. But the difference is Joffrey on Game of Thrones is actually a great actor, and he's capable of making you hate him, which in some level I respect. Whereas Dana is just awful in all respects. Her character is awful. Her acting is awful. Everything about her devalues that show. I really wish she'd be a terrorist attack victim on Homeland Season 3.
It definitely changes the dynamic, that's for sure. But like you said, to get Joffrey out there, to have so many people actually hate him, it's a credit to the way he's played the role. And I was going to say, I'm not a fantasy, a Dungeons & Dragons fan, anything along those lines, but encourage any of the sports fans out there, you watch the first couple episodes from Season 1, you will officially be addicted, and if not, there's probably something wrong with you.
It probably means you don't like sex and violence, which I think history has shown us that Americans are quite confident and happy with both.